On this week's show, what do building codes and the changes in SEO mean to construction? A special news episode with Scott Reynolds from UpCodes. All right, we're back. We threw this one together quickly. Scott's on kind of the start of a vacation. Nathan's in the middle of a vacation, and I'm on a staycation. I'm back at home, which for me is a vacation from the road. So for those of us road warriors, this is a vacation from the road for me. Scott, where are you joining in from today, man?
I'm calling you from home, so just north of San Francisco in Mill Valley.
All right, Mill Valley. You are back home. That's right. You were traveling before, but you're back home now.
Yep, got in at 2 a.m. last night, just a little bit of a delay from our flight back from New Jersey.
Nobody knows delays these days, you know. That's like the norm now. Nathan, where are you coming to us from this morning, man?
I am up at 10,000 feet in Breckenridge, Colorado. So sucking all my air as much as I can and trying to participate. So happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad to get both of you together to sit down. This is going to be a really interesting news episode. But before we get into it, follow us on the socials. Check us out on YouTube, youtube.com/@thecontechcrew, to learn more and to get the shorts. By the way, thanks, guys. You're out there. I'm seeing the signups. Go, go, go. All right, crew, it's back. The next evolution of Bluebeam's legendary user conference, XCon, is here. It's called Unbound, and it's coming to DC this fall, September 30th to October 2nd. You know the vibe. Expert insights from industry leaders, cutting-edge construction tech, Bluebeam training and certification, and unparalleled networking with your global peers. Unbound takes that legacy to the next level with new AI-powered workflows, global AEC connections. But don't worry, they kept the free Bluebeam certifications. Keynotes from my hero, Duncan Wardle, former head of innovation and creativity at Disney, and Apple's legendary co-founder, Steve Wozniak. Use our exclusive code, UnboundTheCrew, for a discount. And join us as Bluebeam evolves and leads the digital construction movement. Register now at unbound.bluebeam.com, and we'll see you there. Use code UnboundTheCrew. All right. So we're going to sit down. We're calling this a news episode because I was sitting down with the team from UpCodes. So you guys know truth and transparency here on the show. And we got into two discussions, and I was like, wait, why are we having these discussions here? We should bring this to the masses. Get Scott back on. If you want to know about the history of UpCodes and who they are and what they are, go back and listen to the episode. But for those who are driving now and are like, really, Jeff, you want me to go back and listen? I don't have time. Scott, get us up to date, like the quick, who is UpCodes? What's the thing we've been dealing with? And we'll get into why we're back together.
Yeah, sure thing. So from a very high level at UpCodes, we bring together a lot of the building codes, plumbing codes, fire codes, put that together into one platform and just make it easily searchable and accessible that anyone in the industry or out of the industry can see. So as it turns out, it's been a little bit of a contentious topic. Can different organizations, the SDOs that convene the committees, can they copyright the code? So we've always had the stance that the public needs free access and open access to actually understand their legal requirements. But over the last 20 plus years now, there's been a legal fight. Can people copyright the laws? Can they own and like think about how people access and or basically put a bottleneck in front of those codes? So that's kind of like the high level overview. We've been litigating it for nearly 10 years now. Other organizations and public interest groups have also been litigating it a little longer than we have. And over time, the courts have always started to side the side of saying, no, you can't copyright the law. Now, as we fight that out in the legal system, a lot of the SDOs have started to kind of try a new tactic. They're trying to go around the American legal system, go to Congress, introduce a bill saying own access and copyright after things have become the law. So that's the kind of context. That push in Congress, I think it started nearly 4 years ago. It failed the first Congress. They tried to fail the second Congress. And now they've just reintroduced it into the third Congress.
Which is why we sat down to get together. SDO is the Standards Development Organizations, just so people who know our little acronyms out there. It's not some new BIM, VDC, and SDO. It's Standards Development Organizations. And to go a little deeper, like these Standards Development Organizations do spend a lot of money and a lot of time in developing these things along the way. And that's kind of their side of like, you know, this is what they've developed. It's their IP, et cetera. And that's where things get interesting.
Yeah. And maybe I'll make a quick point there. So the codes are actually written by volunteers. These are industry professionals, so architects, engineers, people from construction, or government officials. They come together, they draft proposals, they actually write the content of the codes. The SDOs convene the committees that actually write the codes. So I think that is a very important distinction. These codes are written by volunteers.
Well, I think it's both. I think there's a difference between organizations. I mean, we know a lot of them, SMACNN and other trade organizations, NFPA, I know being one that's mentioned a lot, the fire protection, but they are both member organizations that write standards, as opposed to, I know when I just Googled this Pro Codes Act, the first thing that pops up is the ICC, the International Code Council, that really like their primary job is codes themselves, right? So I would put them in a different category than say a trade organization that produces standards that then become code, or maybe I'm missing, and it's apples and oranges, Scott, but like, because to me that there is some nuance there for our group of like the difference between the sole like in it for just the codes versus trade orgs that produce it on behalf of their member orgs, and then at some point, you know, they may get adopted by law.
Yeah, well, I think cutting across them all, it's all these committees and volunteers coming together, whether it's a trade organization or just public volunteers writing the code. So that's a common through line through all the different organizations. But I will say, like, when you look at something like ICC, I think it's something like 15 or 20% of the revenue comes from publication sales. So I think a lot of people think of them as kind of producing the code and the revenue comes from selling the code. But it turns out the lion's share of the revenue actually comes from all the surrounding services they offer, like accreditation and training, building product certification. So, or testing, I should say. So the lion's share of that revenue actually comes from the surrounding pieces around the actual code. Now that just, you know, changes per organization, but just to use ICC as an example, it's actually quite a diverse set of revenue streams.
You know, I guess maybe my question, because again, I'm just going to put on the trade contractor hat and kind of, you know, a lot of what they produce is for their folks. And I don't know how much control they have over whether or not something gets chosen to be public or not. And so I guess, yeah, like if I'm, you know, going to empathize with them for 1 second here, I think my question would be, yeah, like, yeah, is it worth anything? Because I think it needs to be public domain. And Jeff, we were having this debate offline of like, once something becomes law, it becomes public. But it's almost like if I'm a private company and I go public, I IPO, like it's still my company, but I have way less control over it, right? And I'm like, I'm trying to draw the parallel in this situation of like, what is the right appropriate amount of, it should be freely accessible to all, and you should be able to do and manipulate and use it, you know, as such. But they did create it, so there should be, you know, something for it. I don't know. I'm just playing devil's advocate, but there's probably an argument on both sides.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and I think for us, it really comes down to what is the law and what's not the law. I think there's a lot of kind of standards or guides that do not carry the force of law. But if you could get criminal or civil fines and charges for something the government imposes on you as an individual, you could be an architect, an engineer, you know, GC, or you could be a homeowner or developer. But if the government at the federal level, at the state level is saying we mandate this, you must follow this, or it's illegal if you don't. In some cases, like unfortunately, in some of the really bad fires, like that was criminal. People were charged criminally for these things. And if there's text that the government imposes on you, like it's just our belief that a citizen should be able to read that. Like we shouldn't have, or we shouldn't grant monopolies to people for the text that we're legally bound by. Now, to go back, like not everything is, you know, carries legal weight. There's a lot of things out there that don't, you know, CSI, Specifications Institute comes to mind. Like that is not, as far as I know, but the most of that's not adopted into law. That's something you opt into. That's, you know, we're writing our specs, we're doing product research. You don't have to follow CSI guidelines or their organization and categories. So that's like an interesting example, you know, something that's not the law, something that is the law. So you have to have a fire sprinkler in here, or you can't build that building, or the inspector won't give you sign off. So for us, that's the kind of clear distinction.
Yeah. And I like the distinction because it's what's law and criminal needs to be accessible, because there's also this layer of who can access it. And you kind of said it in there, like, it can be a homeowner all the way up to giant organizations that have the people power to process and consume and stay on top of this. It's just that the law is supposed to be fair and accessible to all if we're intended to follow it. That's the difference. And you're not saying that you're taking away that lion's share. You're just saying we're making this digitally accessible to more people. And there's quite far more small contractors and small home builders and et cetera. And they need access to it, and they don't currently have as ease. And so it makes it a little unbalanced.
And you know what? I got the better analogy now for it. Is it's about the trademark law. Like Kleenex is probably the bad example because they actually were able to hold on to their trademark. But it's like, once you get to that point where it's so genericized, yeah, it becomes public domain. You lose it. And so, yeah, I'm with you. I agree with you that at the end of the day, it should be open, and it is public domain because it's law, and that they can choose, like CSI, to say, no, we're going to stay in the contract spec domain and not go into the legal domain. But once you're allowing yourself into the legal domain, you're putting it up to making it public. So yeah, I agree with your argument.
Yeah, I think if you could be on the receiving end of a fine or a jail sentence, you should probably be able to understand like what the requirement was upstream. Like, you should probably understand like what you're bound by. I think a really interesting example is the accessibility board at the federal level. So they think about like wheelchair accessibility in buildings. I mean, they do a lot of different focuses, one of being the ADA standards, but they specifically say, they're like, our intention is to make a safer world and a more accessible built environment. We want you to spread the codes as much as possible. In the beginning of the publication, where you would typically see the copyright claims, they say, no, our objective is just to make buildings more accessible. The more people that know the rules, talk the rules, build tools on top of this, the better buildings we're going to have at the end of the day. And I think that's the ultimate goal. We want a safer environment. These codes do a really important thing: fire codes, building codes, electrical codes. Like, they're incredibly important for safety and the quality of our buildings. But for that exact reason, we all need to be able to understand what they are, apply them, and think about tools. Jeff, just to go off something you said, like, you're talking about the importance of free access, and I very much agree. Free access is critical, but free access we consider like the foundation. That's just the base. Ideally, people can get in there and read the text, but even better is if we have tools built on top of that, automated tools that can get in there and just make it a lot easier for people to understand the requirements. Like, we do a lot of that work, but there could be a lot more done for different areas of the code.
Well, there's a lot of places where this is going on. It's not in the, you know, this specific domain alone. It's in a lot of other areas to try to speed up and understand and make sense of data that exists in the public world. The difference here is that somebody's trying to kind of control the ability to build those tools and to do those things for everyone. And I think people do need to understand that, like, the codes themselves are built in such a way to create that safety, to create that better environment, better built world. So if they're so much harder to get to, it's going to prevent us from building at the level that we should, because we don't have access to it. And also, let's just be honest, like, the SDOs are going through an evolution and a disruption in some respects. Like, it's supposed to be an evolution. A disruption in my mind here, the Pro Codes Act is them trying to prevent a disruption. And when you fight something to the end, you will be disrupted. You have the opportunity. And this is going on in construction as well. How many people still fight technology and construction and building new different ways and evolving? the SDOs have to evolve to continue to maintain their businesses. They have to continue to maintain, but they've got to get ahead of and evolve with this process in order to stay relevant. This is just, this is how life goes, right? These were, you know, pieces of paper and books, like you said, originally, and now we got the internet thing, and now they're on the internet. Now we have AI. Now we have APIs. Like, this is an evolution.
The Forbes article said it, actually, Scott. I want to get your point on what the Forbes article said about, I think more or less my interpretation was that having that sort of paywall is going to bottleneck innovation. That it's going to curtail opportunities to do things because it's going to restrict that. I mean, is that, that's essentially the core of the argument, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And actually, I just want to go back really quickly to something Jeff said about the evolution and potential disruption. I think from our perspective, there actually has been little disruption. So you look at ICC, they've been fighting this battle in the courts for 20 years now, and they've been losing for 20 years. They lose every single time. And against others, against us. But despite that, their revenue grows every year, year on year. And if you look at the graph, it's up and to the right. So 10 years ago, they were making right around 50 million in revenue. Today, they make over 100 million. Their CEO gets paid 10 times the national average of a nonprofit CEO. So while they do like to talk about the difficulty of, you know, in the future, if the copyright's lost, well, so guess what? That the courts already made that ruling, and you're literally making more money than you ever have, and the graph is up and to the right. So I'm not sure how much disruption there is here, because it all, like, you look at NFPA, same thing, graph up and to the right, making more money than they ever have. These are all in their tax filings, so you can go through the 990s and see all the revenue breakdown. So just to kind of point that out, you know, I don't think it's like history has shown that it's not as disruptive as they like to claim.
So that's what I mean, is it's not. It really isn't. But they're fighting it as though it will be. And, you know, they're fighting over this little piece instead of understanding that since they're up and to the right, there's got to be ways. If they took all that money that they spent trying to prevent it and invested in how to make it better, accessibility wise, but then maximize the continued profit on it, I think they're up and to the right would be even more.
Yeah, I agree. And you're talking about advancements in AI and all these different areas. If the focus went into innovation, so let's let everyone have free access to the underlying content, to what is the law? They should access that. But it's all these things you could build on top of it. And Nate, that's why you're mentioning like the potential bottleneck on innovation. There's so much potential here. Why are we fighting about just public access to these adopted laws? Yeah, I think it's a real shame. I could go on for a while, but I think there has been a huge amount of stifling of innovation in the space.
When I love your point about just go look up their tax filings, it's like, yeah, the truth shall set you free, right? It's like you can say one thing, but at the end of the day, your tax filings are going to say another.
Well, and that's an interesting thing here too, Nathan, because to go to one of your earlier analogies, when you're a private company, your books are your books. And you can cook them however you want. And yes, there's some legal things you've got to be careful of, whatnot, filing taxes, all that kind of thing, right? But nobody can really subpoena your tax records for a private organization. Once you go public and you are now beholden to the street, to Wall Street and to investors, you have to have tax filings. You have to have quarterly earnings. You have to do these things and produce a level of transparency to the information so that the people investing in you and working with you have clear access. So when you go from private to public, things change. And I think you see that. We discussed CSI being private and the fact that, you know, happily you can access it by paying for it and playing along, or you can decide, I don't want to play along, right? Like, you don't have to. So this is the difference in the scale at which we really want to get out there and understand how it's impacting and what it can do.
And just to double down quickly on that, because we talk so much about contracts, right? And I think your point, Scott, that the law is a different level above the contract. The contract controls specs like CSI and other IFC and ISO and other standards, but that's different from the law, which is really what you're talking about, where the designer and the builder and the inspector all have to follow the same code. And yeah, it's apples and oranges when you try and compare the two.
Yeah, exactly. And so sometimes some of these STOs will say, like, it's not our fault it became the law. That's not our fault. But the reality is that millions of dollars are spent lobbying the governments to actually adopt these things into law. So they write them with the intent to become law. They spend lots of money. They have people on staff that lobby the government. They hire a lobbyist in DC. There's a huge amount of focus to get these adopted into law. So not only do we draw that clear distinction, it's also a very intentional play on their part. And you know, when you do make the conscious choice and it becomes adopted, like that is, you know, in our mind, very different than, like you're saying, like specs. Like you don't have to follow the CSI categories. You don't have to choose certain building products. You don't have to write it a certain way. It's your prerogative, and the government doesn't force it on you. So that's our big distinction.
Well, that's what we wanted to talk about, that, and we want to talk about their evolution. And it was interesting because when I sat down, like I said, I sat down with the UpCoach team, and that's where this episode came from. And it was very interesting because we started talking about this, but then I started talking about industries that were being disrupted and changed and how it was going to impact construction. And we dove into what some are calling the death of SEO. And this is a floating around topic that you hear kind of offhandedly in Slack channels and other places amongst the construction technologists and the people in construction tech about how that world is changing right now. And it was really interesting for your team when we started talking about it. I'll be open and honest. We were talking about advertising and being on the show and doing a couple of other things together. And your new head of marketing, Christy, right? Head of marketing, correct?
Right. Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
I said, you know, we might not be your, you know, place for putting information. And she said, aha, I think you're wrong. Right. I think the type of content that you're building here is more valuable than it ever was before. And we started diving into this idea that, you know, and I'll just talk about the article because we're going to put these out there for everybody. Sorry, we were talking about earlier Forbes and the Procodes and an article they wrote. We will be sharing that out. And we'll also be sharing out Scott's post as sort of how UpCodes and others felt about it. So don't worry, we're going to do this like a true news episode. But this one came from Tactical, and it's how HubSpot's SEO got crushed. Lessons from an 80% loss in organic traffic. So some of you may have heard this whole AI thing's out there. And people like Google and others are changing and adapting and moving. And it's having downstream effects on what classic marketing and classic distribution of information and driving traffic to your organization has changed significantly. And now we'll have another article about, did HubSpot really lose 80% of blog traffic? Here's what actually happened and what it means for marketers. So there was a kind of reaction to that. So I wanted to lay this out there that everybody's like, Jeff, how does this have anything to do with construction? Well, it does. It has a huge impact on construction. And I wanted to put it out there. And Scott, if you can talk a little bit about how you see this and this change impacting, you know, some of the daily lives of people who are driving down the road right now listening to us.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, going back to the topic of things changing, the rate of change currently in technology is faster than it's ever been, specifically because it's all software. Like we have hardware, we have our phones in our pocket, we have our computers, and now it's just adopting these new tools, which in this case is AI, and it's changing dramatically. I mean, the HubSpot example was, I think, in some regard, it's terrifying, right? Like an 80% drop, their entire go to market, the way they kind of got their business out there, just in the course of months, just you know, completely falls through. And you know, maybe they say it's not 80%, but it's just one example of many. There's Stack Overflows, I think, saw a 50%+ drop, almost like a step function, just overnight drop when ChatGPT was bursting onto the scene. So it is something to be really, really mindful. And what we have seen is that I think a lot of engagement where you meet your community is just changing. Like the channels change. It might not be traditional SEO. It's not going to Google, clicking on the 10 blue links. People find their information in much more organic ways. And I'd argue much better ways. Like it's like I use ChatGPT. I used Gemini. The sources of the content I consume or the information I find is completely different than it was 18 months ago. And I think for the better. I think I'm more successful in getting to different information and getting there faster. But to bring this full circle, Jeff, to what you're saying is like, I think businesses, firms, departments, everyone needs to kind of adapt to make sure they're getting in front of where users are going to consume that information in the future.
And those channels are changing completely. And that was what, you know, HubSpot's, you know, answer was we removed 30,000 top, what they call top of funnel articles, which, so for people who understand, you know, you're a software company, you're a building product manufacturing company, you're going to put out blogs to drive people to your site. You know, you're a construction software company. You're going to put out blogs to drive SEO traffic to you so that then they can get into the funnel and you can access those people and try to sell them product. Well, what happened in the change, if I understand it correctly, and based on a lot of the technology in the background, is the algorithms were originally just, you know, consuming those keywords and driving traffic. So the more, the better. And that's top of funnel. So, you know, guys, when you get to a site, you go into the funnel, you're top of funnel. We don't know if we want you or not. We're going to take you through a process to see if we could value you and your target and we can go after you. That's exactly what's happening. It's happening in all areas. So, but what they did is they stopped, and it not only stopped ranking things that didn't connect to your core company and core offerings, they actually started penalizing for content that was not specific to what you were out there talking about and what services you provide or what products you provide. And that's why HubSpot had a number of articles out there that were, you know, focused more around real estate licenses and how to flush your DNS and, you know, cool things about, you know, cool quotes that people have out there. And they went in and they had to cull them and they had to get rid of them in such a way to then keep more core traffic and core content. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. And maybe, I mean, I've seen it, maybe some listeners have too, but even on YouTube, like you'll see YouTube channels that have been well established for like years, that could be like 10 years, have it just split apart because they can't have a too broad range of interest and things, topics they talk about. So they're splitting channels into 3, 4, 5 different channels, maybe with smaller audiences, but more focused. And it is interesting because that's one, I don't know if it's good or bad, but it is forced upstream by YouTube and, you know, by Google. Like these are conscious decisions they're making. Not sure if that's better or worse, but like that is the change that people are having to adapt, but adapt faster than they ever have before.
I read both the HubSpot and especially the response. And I think if you read the whole response, I don't think anywhere through there do they actually refute the stats themselves. It's just more just, no, here's this understanding of the larger landscape of how the industry is changing. So we're not the only one. It's kind of like, maybe it's not as bad as 80%, but it's probably more than 50%. You know, they didn't want to share what that number was. But yeah, as to your point, yeah, it's bad across the board. And it's a sign that one tweak to the system can create these ripple impacts like a ChatGPT. And so, yeah, how else is this going to show itself in other areas, I think is our broader question, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because I think some of these software companies tend to iterate very, very quickly. Like they can move really quickly and they tend to be the canary in the coal mine because it is as quickly as it can go positive, it can go negative as well. So they have to iterate, they have to move fast. But they're great examples to look at on the horizon to see what's coming. So if that's happening to HubSpot today, how does that affect construction tomorrow? And I think these case studies are really, really critical for us to digest and understand how does it impact our business. And if you're a manufacturer, if you're an architect, an engineer, a GC, like how do you think about reaching your customers or your community and studying these examples? Now we've kind of had an interesting kind of product development there. Happy to jump into that in a moment, but yeah, curious to get.
Well, I feel the same way, and it's kind of cool because I get to, you know, say for once that like this is why these different mediums are so important, and why sort of, and I'll quote a Jonathan Marsh, you know, becoming anti-fragile as an organization, you can't just have one thing because that one thing can come toppling down, right? You have to have a diversity of meeting your customers where they are. And what I think is cool about it is, in reality, at least that canary is saying, hey, if you've been just putting out junk and filling it full of SEO, thanks to AI, right? Like part of this got worse in the beginning because everybody and their brother can write an article right now on being an expert in whatever they want by throwing it through ChatGPT, doing a deep dive, changing a few things and make it sound cool. And it's irrelevant. Right. It's not important. It created more noise. And so in some of those Slack channels I was talking about, you're like, please, God, stop posting these things and stop sending me these emails and stop doing that. And I think this is a cool canary out there of like, hey, this whole thing's about to swing the other way. So get your ducks in order. And, you know, Scott, I want to know what you guys are doing. But for other organizations, it's like, oh, we have to think about these mediums. We have to think about podcasts. I mean, look, let's be honest. Like, we just had a crazy election and it was highly impacted by the one side's ability to leverage podcasts and alternative sources of information. I'm not going into the battle of it. I'm just saying it had a huge impact. We know it did. And it, again, a canary in the coal mine. It's teaching us that we must make our content specific, have diverse areas. Some people still read, some people don't. And all they do is consume snippets and consume YouTube and podcasts. And so there's lots of different places for people to go. And I hope this actually revalues very highly specific, valuable content based on what the services and offerings or software that you are providing. Because that is going to drive the noise. And just like upcodes wanting to get you to the codes faster and understanding them, maybe you can get to the solutions that you need faster by understanding that you have to understand your audience now. So that's my take on it, Nathan. I wonder if I missed anything in there, sparks anything.
I think going back to Scott, all your points, the only thing I would add is, I mean, Contech is the first, if they're not feeling it already, they're going to be the first ones to feel it in their audience. Again, me, yourself and others, Scott. And so if I'm a Blue Beam, if I'm a Trimble, if I'm anyone, like that's, I've absolutely seen the top funnel generalization of content craze. And so, yeah, sort of that wake up call to diversify your content, to go deep on things and create, yeah, all those different mediums, which is, well, you say it's easier said than done, but shoot, anymore with AI and ChatGPT and Otter and transcriptions and other things, like it's crazy how quickly you can create multimedia content with very little kind of human capital input. But it takes a lot of preparation, a lot of forethought, a lot of this, you know, systems level thinking to do. So it's just, yeah, we've got a long way to go as construction, but thankfully there's a lot of canaries in that coal mine showing us all the mistakes to hopefully not make along the way.
Yeah, and just to double click on the diversity topic and going to different channels, I think a related topic is meeting the user where they are. So I think more than ever, different kinds of content are getting jammed into the same channels. So to give an example, when I go to YouTube, I might be looking at AI analysis videos, things that are coming up, or maybe it's like a tech analysis, but Contech Crew shorts will come up on YouTube. So all of a sudden, I'm in the same, you know, channel. I'm in YouTube, but I'm getting so many different pieces of content. I think it's about making sure you are where the user is, where they're going to be consuming that content or making a decision point. So that's a great example of like Contech, you know, meeting you when I'm researching AI topics or getting deep dive analysis videos. Now bringing it back to construction, like one of the things we think about is exactly that, bringing different kinds of content together into one place. So like, you know, where we started this episode is where we started the company, which is building codes and regulations, but we've expanded a lot since, and we've gone into assemblies like UL assemblies or GA assemblies. We've gone into building products, and trying to close that loop into an end-to-end experience. So you're in one place, one platform. You can see your requirements outlaid by the code. Maybe, you know, needs to be fire sprinklered, or maybe this wall needs to be 2-hour rated wall. What next? Okay, well, what's the assembly for that wall? What assembly? What are my options I can do for that? Once I'm honing down on an assembly, what are the building products I can use? Starting to think about the building products, and then maybe, you know, what are you thinking about specification? How do you tie this all together? So I think it's exactly that, getting your information exactly where the user is, and it's a win-win. So you meet the user gets all the information they need that maybe they didn't things to proactively go look for, but now they can be a little bit more passive and let that information come to them.
Yeah, it's a philosophy. It's funny because I was saying this all last year, and I'll always continue to say it. It's why I want all of the platforms to begin to flow information back and forth, kind of like the codes thing, right? Because I think connecting them to value and creating more value by connection will actually drive them up and to the right. What I mean by that is every user is, I think, soon going to have a particular platform or area or space that they are in. And so it should be right user, right place, right time, in the right product for them, right? Not every product can be for everybody. And so surfacing those other pieces of information. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, this 2-hour rated wall, I'm going to make sure that it, you know, fits the law and the legal requirements. Then I need to know what my options are, cost, ability, make sure it's up to spec, et cetera, other things. I want to be in one place doing that. And you're providing that option. When I want somebody in the field who's working on something, I want them in their platform, and I want them to be able to know from upcodes, like, the reason this was spec'd this way and the reason this was chosen is because it follows this particular code that we have to have in this. And that doesn't need to be over there. It needs to be over here. So because that user is consuming information, they're driving use of your platform, and they're driving use of the platform that they're in. Each one of these platforms needs to understand how they can impact the other and drive up usage.
Yeah, I think what you said, right user at the right time at the right place, is exactly it. Like, 10 years ago is so fragmented. It was one size fits all for every use case, for every user, for every project. But I think, I mean, more so today, but especially in the future, it's all about full customization for that user. What do they need in that moment? Don't show them things that are irrelevant. Don't create a lot of bloat and a lot of clutter. Just show exactly, like, be a little bit proactive, put things in front of them they didn't know they were going to do next, but be as helpful as possible and make it completely tailored to that experience. And Jeff, I agree. I think people will not be jumping around different point solutions and into different places, but rather staying in their workflow, staying in that, ideally in that software, ideally there's integrations. I don't know, maybe you're in Revit or you're in Procore or you're in Bluebeam. But if you're in that workflow, pull in all this other information, pull in all this other content, connect the dots, or, you know, or maybe you're in upcodes and you're doing code research, but pulling in different information from the other pieces, like your Revit model. So you don't have to jump over to Revit. You don't have to jump over to Bluebeam and vice versa. So I think it's this, I think we talk about this all the time, but I think it's more important than ever is this exchange.
But I love how you started, because you didn't start with any of the softwares. You started with describing the problem, right? Like, everything you described were things that have existed for a long time before technology and will continue to exist after. And it's, how do we understand technology's impact on these things, like codes and specs and you know, how they impact inspections and permits and different things like that. And so, yeah, I think you're spot on. Of, if you're not starting with the problem first, none of these solutions really matter.
Yeah, and you nailed it there, Nathan, because the other thing is, and I say this to startups all the time and to anyone in software that's trying to do this, if you want to be everything to everybody, then you're nothing to nobody. And I think that now goes to your content as well, and content strategies. If you're trying to just put out everything for everybody, you're going to be nothing for nobody anymore, right? It's got to draw back to what you do, which is awesome for the end user too, right? Because you're now meeting them and being forced to meet them with much more valuable, much more specific content. Like, I'm thinking of names and people in my head here that are going to just absolutely love this as it happens. And you're also going to have to be able to, you know, it used to be like, you know, put it all out there and just, crap, we'll figure it out as we go. I think it's going to be much more like, hey, this is my specific area. These are my specific people. And this is how I drive a ton of value. And okay, now I need to know the other things, the other places, the other pieces they need. And like you said, it's the great use of AI, Scott, that it's probabilistic, right? It's not deterministic. Like, you didn't say, I'm going to give them their next step. You said, through the AI, I'm going to offer them things that they might want as a next step. Because the probability of what the AI is telling me is, these are probably things you want. You're going to be choosing, yeah, I do, yeah, no, I don't. But that's a huge opportunity, because you're not just consuming from your platform. You've got other indicators that are driving it and are going to get us to, you know, wouldn't you actually like to get, you know, into something, have an idea, and not realize a product's available for that? And hey, did you know that this exists? No, I didn't. Great. Thank you.
Yeah. And just to go off of what you said, putting it all out there, that was a historical playbook. But when you do that, you're just putting the onus on the user to figure out what's relevant to them. And you, in a way, it's very lazy. It's just like, hey, here's all the options. Good luck. And you can figure it out. I mean, you think about a newspaper, like, you know, back in the day, it's a print newspaper. Everyone gets the same exact newspaper. They have to figure out, what are they interested in? Flip to the right sections. And maybe it's there, maybe it's not. But more and more, that experience is completely tailored to that user. What are your interests? What's the feed going to be? Ideally putting in things they want, but then also injecting things maybe they didn't know they wanted, but might be interested. And sure, they could dismiss it, but maybe they like it, and it starts to get more and more of it.
Well, here's a quick tangent. So yeah, so how do you dispel fake news or fake codes or fake, you know, all the fakeness out there through this process too, right? Of making it open, but then some sort of validation that it is open, that it is a law, and it's not just something that somebody else made up, right? Like, hopefully something good comes out of this where there is a clear distinction that you can go off of to say, yeah, it is certified versus not certified.
Yeah, and that's a great use case, because matching a user in a project to things that are relevant for them, certifications, whether it's coming from organizations or governments, that's a great way, because you know it's official, you know it's right, and you know it's relevant to the user. So maybe they're working in Miami-Dade. We were actually just talking about this yesterday. They're working in Miami-Dade, and it needs to be approved by Miami-Dade. So there, right away, we can start to parse down all these building products and all these choices and assemblies. And obviously, the codes need to parse down because of their location. But all of a sudden, you start from this huge set, and you can start to bring it down. And that validation point can be certifications. It can be these stamps of approvals that you get, or EPDs, or performance requirements. So there's so many ways we can very, very intelligently go from literally hundreds of thousands of building products down to maybe like four. Like, here's four. And you could, they all work for you, but here's a high level overview of the four, and you can make your choice from that four. But I think cutting it down from a huge number to a very, very small number is the hard and kind of tedious work. And
you're describing such a disruptive idea to that person that's making that decision, because it's so intuitive. Like, to me, I'm like, that is so intuitive, but it's so foreign to the way that someone would traditionally make those decisions that, yeah, like their initial reaction is, whoa, 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 I don't feel comfortable doing that. But yet it is intuitively the right answer. I mean, I don't know. Do you face pushback ever, or is it just everyone's like totally on board with it?
I think the biggest pushback is just making sure all options are considered, because you don't want to make a decision where you have maybe like half of your options are represented and you're going to get some item within that half. So, I mean, we understood that from day one. So like, it's always about communicating that we're going to try and get you the biggest selection set possible. That's the top of funnel, which historically is really hard to do manually, because again, literally hundreds of thousands of these things. But how do we, from a technology perspective, get the biggest set at the top of the funnel and then narrow that down to the narrowest, most streamlined possible decision for the user?
And when done correctly, they can understand those filters and the transparency of how you got there. And if they need to go back and tweak, they realize my top of funnel was this big. I got here because I did these things. So let me, you know, it's just like, it's like any sort and find, right? You know what you sorted and found and how. It's just doing it faster and based off other input, but you can unwrap it and go back and come down and go back. And that's the power of really well-built software that really takes advantage of the current, you know, technology that exists right now, and it's going to get considerably better and faster. And I like to tie all things back, and I have my favorite quote from Rick Kahn is, the number one KPI in construction is time to decision-making. That is the key, because time is money. We can print more money. We know we can. We can charge more money. We know we can. The thing we cannot make is time. And we have a limited amount of it, and we don't use it effectively, and it's far more valuable. So the ability to use these tools to speed up, you know, to getting to a decision. And I think that's the golden thread between the beginning of our episode to now is speed to decision-making, but taking into account all of the information required to make a really good decision and the transparency and understanding where that came from. So, and that's what we do. You know, that's the change in SEO is coming around those kind of things. The access to the codes is changing and we need to think about those things. So Nathan, what do you have? Final thoughts? Cause we got to wrap her up.
Last thing to add is just, measuring the waste of that indecision. Cause to your point, yes, that is the value, but if we don't measure the waste that's created from the indecision, we are not going to be able to make that argument next time around. And so, yeah, it starts by measuring the waste and then gets to that. I love that TTD, time to decision.
Yeah. I think with the TTD, the way you can unlock that is technology. And Jeff, you're saying this too, but it's, we need that layer on top that can give us a really sophisticated set of analysis that we can take it across the line. We can make that a very educated decision to take it across the line. But to go back to the beginning of the episode, if you lock down that foundational layer, you'll just never get that technology to make a decision, informed decision. And I think that's why we see billions of dollars in construction rework. We see delayed permits. We see friction across the whole construction lifecycle is because that foundational layer has just been stagnating for literally decades.
Yeah, for decades. And the people that are suffering the most from it are the people that want to use the infrastructure, who need the housing, who need the things that we build in this world. So just to tie it all back to why we're here and why the built world is, in my opinion, the best business in the world to be in. So thank you, Scott, for jumping on and taking a quick time out this week. Nathan, thank you for taking time out of your break to join us. Scott, tell people where they can learn more about you and catch up with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So the website's probably the best place. So if you Google Upcodes, if you're thinking about the advocacy, you could do Upcodes, Pro Codes Act, or you know, free law or anything like that. That'll get you to the site. And we love hearing from the community. So if you want to reach out over email or the chat on the website, we love connecting with folks and just talking through projects, talking through how can we make things more efficient. So always love to connect with everybody.
Scott Reynolds, I'm going to recommend everybody go hit you on LinkedIn too, because you're a great follow on LinkedIn. I learn a lot from you all the time. So I'm going to say that. Nathan, thanks for taking time out of your vacation to join me today to jump into this one.
Oh man, glad I could make time. Scott, thank you. This was fun. I learned a ton.
Likewise. Yeah, thanks so much for carving out the time. Great to talk.
And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our special news episode with Scott Reynolds. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to the show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is the Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.